from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from Eskenazi Health. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
I'm Sharon Gamble. Welcome to The Art of the Matter. On today's show, we discover poet Norbert Kraup's new prose memoir, meet two Stutz artists prepping for the holidays, and learn about the Department of Public Words. And don't forget, we'll have that arts calendar recall.
What'll we do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. This week on our show, we'll channel Bob Dylan and the band, get all the muse from the upcoming Internet Cat Video Festival, and start our holiday shopping as we learn about the Stutz Holiday Open House. But first, have you wondered where all those signs that assure you that you are beautiful come from? The Department of Public Words is an Indianapolis-based organization founded to create positive messages in public spaces through both art and public speaking. Co-founders Dave and Holly Combs have been challenging and inspiring our community through their mission since 2007, and they've fostered many relationships with individuals and community partners alike. Contributor Pete Brown sat down with Dave and Holly to learn more about their early experiences with public art engagement and where they're headed in the future.
Let's talk a little bit about DPW, the Department of Public Words. And you have this interesting history of street art, and together you're doing that, and together you're stepping into Peel Magazine and the concept of fighting to ban a font, you know? I mean, how does this all gel and sit together and turn into this Indianapolis-based organization that's dedicated to creating positive messages in public spaces? I mean, how did the Department of Public Words come to be?
I wish I could say we had a very elaborate 10-year plan that involved all of this, but it really wasn't like that at all. The street art part started for me as a zine, and it was just something that I had always wanted to do, to make a zine.
And a zine is
zine is basically a magazine, but kind of a do-it-yourself, black and white, typically half-size, like 8.5 by 11, folded in half piece of paper.
All right.
And then photocopied and given to your friends or maybe sold online or something. But I had always wanted to make a zine, and that is where it started. And Holly came along after I started making the zine and said, we've got to do this for real. Like, we can't just kind of do this halfway. So she was very instrumental in bringing it to the level of being nationally distributed and being full color, everything like that. I would have kind of just done it at a very do-it-yourself level forever, but
yeah, so we had kids, and so I think it's really interesting in a marriage and then having kids how you start thinking about how to make money. So I actually thought if we could make a very beautiful magazine, perhaps we could really be the first people to document art in public spaces focused on stickers in the whole wide world. That went really well until, like, the economy tanked in 2008. And during that time, I had something, a need in my own personal heart that I felt like the whole world needed. And while our magazine was going down, we were signing books all over the United States, our book. We were published authors and telling people to live their dreams. And we were signing bankruptcy papers and giving the bank back our house. And that's what living your dreams looks like. We're not afraid to fail. I think failing is a part of success. So during that time, we put up the You Are Beautiful on the top of the Murphy Art Center.
Absolutely. I don't know if there's a person in the city that hasn't seen that or, you know, been moved by that, really.
Right. And, you know, I have to say that those are the things that I think change your whole life's trajectory, because I needed it desperately in that moment. I needed to know that all the success that we had didn't land us in a place of financial success. But I realized in that moment how rich we were, that we had a city that would allow us to put three words on the top of a building. And it's a little bit easier to do things here in Indianapolis when I think it would have taken 2 years to get those permissions, you know? So those three words went in my heart, and I said, Matthew Hoffman can run an organization from Chicago and use three words to empower people. What if we had a lot to say? What if we could, like, take what we've learned and become something really powerful for our city. And I saw a huge gap that people weren't getting enough encouragement. So during those years that we were sitting, 2009, 2010, I remembered how much I love stickers, and I began to work with students all over the state. I became an art teacher. I didn't want to be an art teacher. I told myself I'd never be a teacher. My mom worked for IPS for 30 years, and I didn't want to be a teacher, but I was gifted at it. I enjoyed being with kids, and they loved me, which was cool. but then I started thinking about my love for stickers and how could I use that to help people. So that's how the Department of Public Works really started, was through our love for public art and my love for people, and a therapeutic approach to use stickers to help people remove the labels that have unfairly been placed on them by society or themselves, and then using stickers to empower people to say, I am awesome and amazing and gifted. So we use stickers in a very therapeutic way now.
And it's grown from stickers. I mean, we were talking earlier on our way up here about some of the new pieces that are coming up around town. How did you get into moving more towards murals and public art growing from stickers?
That's a good question. Wow. We always wanted to do bigger art, but we just didn't know how. And after we did the You Are Beautiful piece in Fountain Square, it kind of got in us. We were very inspired by that, and we saw that it's possible, so we wanted to do more of it. And we started telling our friends, like, I think we want to do this as our job, like, put up positive messages. And people said, I don't know if that can be a job. And then Holly said, what if we encourage people for a living? What if we make that our life? And I said, that sounds great. I don't know if it's possible, but let's try.
Well, we saw Brian Payne speaking at the library about how he wanted to retain entrepreneurial creatives in our city. And I felt like he was giving the speech to me and Dave. And I felt like, okay, you want to keep us here because all these other cities are wooing us to go to them. All the bigger cities, Chicago, LA, people say, what, you're doing it from where? Where the race cars are? What? And we're like, yeah, this is a beautiful place to live. And so not being wooed by those other cities, we sat with Brian Payne 3 years ago at Calvin Fletcher. And we just said, hey, Brian, we'd like to encourage people for a living. And the way we want to do that is through public art, large public art pieces, and through therapeutic art processes in prisons, with government officials, with corporate America. We don't care. Everyone needs encouragement. And we see this having a long life. There's never going to be a time people don't need encouraged. And he said, I think it sounds great. I'll be your first backer. So Indianapolis Foundation actually gave us our first grant, and that was 3 years ago.
Wow. Let's sidestep a little bit and talk about You Are Beautiful a little bit more. You're both wearing fantastic You Are Beautiful shirts that everybody in the studio is drooling over, and we can't wait to get ours, which we found out we can get on your website.
That's right.
Talk about the movement a little bit, because did you independently come up with You Are Beautiful, or is this – because I've seen You Are Beautiful pieces popping up on street art websites and graffiti sites. I mean, people that are doing You Are Beautiful pieces – kind of in support of the entire movement, which is You Are Beautiful.
Absolutely. So we would love to let the whole world know that we are not the You Are Beautiful people. The You Are Beautiful founder, his name is Matthew Hoffman, and Dave interviewed him for the zine. That's how this all started. So
funny.
Dave came and said, there's an artist who puts You Are Beautiful on the side of buildings. And I was like, what? Really? That's the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life, to use public space to encourage people. So you have to see the connection of how this inspired us. At that point, Matthew Hoffman was Superman. No one knew who he was. We did for the interview for the zine, but then again kept that secret for a very long time. And because we decided to be the Indiana You Are Beautiful people to jump this project in the state, people started associating us with being the people who started it. And we did not, but we are the Indianapolis people, and this is a worldwide movement that Matthew Hoffman has started. And let me say, it's not his movement. It's the world's movement. It's not our movement. It's the world's movement. He's given it to the people, to the world, and people have run with it with insane vigor because we are desperate to hear these words.
And the You Are Beautiful movement also started with stickers. Matthew made about 100 stickers and passed them out to friends and stuck them up. And so there's a connection there, too.
Contributor Pete Brown with Department of Public Works founders Dave and Holly Combs. For more information on their mission and upcoming projects, visit dpwwords.org, dpwwords.org. If you follow Central Indiana's visual arts scene at all, you know that one of the highlights of the year is the Stutz Artists Association's spring open house. But here's a little secret. Those same artists host a holiday open house, too, with more than 40 artists offering affordable art for gifts on the first Friday of December. Stutz sculptural fiber artist Wendy Franklin and painter Beth Clary Schweer took a break from creating to give me a sneak preview.
Everybody who's lived in Indianapolis for any length of time knows about the spring open house. The holiday open house is a more recent introduction, but it's getting up in years now too, right? It's been going on a few years?
It's been going on every year since I've been in the building, which this will be the fifth holiday open house that I've participated in.
And I know neither of you was probably there at the creation, but what's the basic idea of the holiday open house?
It's a good opportunity for people to come in. It's a much smaller crowd, so you get more of a chance to talk to artists, which is great, a little bit less chaos in the halls. And yeah, it's a good time to pick up. A lot of artists do smaller works that are good for Christmas gifts and things like that.
Yeah. Beth, you were talking before we turned the microphone on about you do a series of cardinals.
Yes.
And they're modest in size and modest in price, but
yes,
so charming.
Thank you.
Are those from life? Do you look out your window? And
well, I have some that I've captured with my own camera. Mm-hmm. Sometimes friends that post on Facebook, I'll ask if I can use some of their images.
Nice.
Yeah.
When did you do work specifically for the holidays or for this event?
Usually for holiday open house, I have a series of dyed silk scarves. I do fiber work, so I'll do some wearables for the holiday open house. It's easy gifts.
And how do you, this is a question for each of you, how do you have a sense of what all artists who sell their work have to walk that fine line between making work that satisfies their own soul and their own aesthetic and maybe making work that the public wants to buy as well? How do you do that, especially when you're working for an event that's explicitly about, you know, we're buying holiday gifts. That's what your public is coming
right.
for. How do you figure that out?
That's a great question. I think you try to find a balance of things that you enjoy that you know other people will. Mm-hmm. And I invariably find that when I do that, the work sells. So
really?
It doesn't have to really
no compromise.
I don't think so. I mean, sometimes I will do a commission for someone that maybe I hadn't or wouldn't have done or never thought of doing.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just an opportunity for growth for me. And when I did the Cardinals last year, they were so widely
popular. Yeah.
So it's encouraged me to do it again this year.
Yeah. When did you keep an inventory of what sells from year to year? Are you that deliberate about it?
I'm not really deliberate about much of anything. So
good girl.
I do a lot of I do what I love. I think there's really just no compromise to it. It's all about balance. So if you bring somebody joy with a $50 silk scarf, to me that's the same as bringing somebody joy with a $3,000 painting. And I sell both ends of the spectrum at the holiday open house because there are some people that are looking for big pieces to decorate their home. Maybe they're having family coming in, and it's just that little extra deadline that's created of getting things all ready for
right.
company
and
things.
It's not necessarily even a holiday focus for the people that are coming there. It's just another opportunity to come to the Stutz to visit our studios because we're only open a few times a year.
Right.
So I get a lot of people back that just have visited my studio before that want to come again. So I'll have a lot of my regular art pieces available and sell.
What a nice tradition.
It's really great. And it's really, this is only my second year, but I'm really looking forward to it because, like Wendy said, you have such it's a relatively smaller crowd. It's still a pretty large crowd that comes, but you have a little more time with your clients to meet and greet people, to spend time. And it's, as an artist, that's so much fun. And to invite people into your studio to share what you've done and been working on, it's really a great night.
And generally, more than 40 artists are open for the holiday open house, so the majority of your compatriots, right?
Right. We have a good following for the artists to participate because we do get that nice sized crowd. It's a fun show. It's really a fun show for everybody because there's a festive atmosphere through the halls. We'll have live music and things. The artists are a little bit more slept and fat and
relaxed.
Less stressed at this versus an April open house. It's a really nice, laid-back, casual kind of atmosphere and a good way to lead up to the April open house, because you'll get, as a person walking the halls, the idea of the flow of the hallways and getting that little idea of who you like and which spaces to go to for April.
Absolutely,
as well.
Yeah.
Beth Clary Schwer and Wendy Franklin. Their studios are just two of the more than 40 that will be open from 5 to 10 p.m. on Friday, December 2nd for the Stutz Holiday Open House. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Later this hour, Henri Le Chat Noir's Filtered Water Tastes Impure and an Indiana poet laureate turns to prose. But first, it's time for Eat, Drink, Indie. This week, Jolene Ketzenberger talks with Indianapolis chef Anna Powell, who's heading out to North Dakota at Thanksgiving to cook for the Standing Rock protesters.
Anna Powell, you're here with us, and we wanted to talk about Thanksgiving and your Thanksgiving plans, because they're not the typical Thanksgiving plans. So if you could tell me a little bit about what you'll be doing this year, that'd be great.
Sure. Yeah. So I do something big every Thanksgiving. I try to do a service project. I believe that Thanksgiving is a time to spend with family and friends and cook really good food. And I also like to share my talent, which is culinary, with the community.
Right, because you're a chef, right?
I am a chef, yeah. So, and I do catering, so it kind of comes natural to me to cook for large amounts of people. It's pretty easy. A few years ago, I started adopting places or people and cooking for them. And so this year, with everything that's going on with Standing Rock, I've just been compelled to do something more instead of just repost things or check in.
Right,
or
the Facebook activism that
we've
been seeing. Right?
Yeah, I want to do more for that community. And so I thought, what a better way than to go and maybe cook a big pot of soup for them or something that when they're out there, you know, protecting their land, they know that other people care about them and we're supporting them.
Well, no, that's very cool. So how do you just decide to go do that? I get the feeling like you've done these sorts of things.
Not last year, but the year before, I started a GoFundMe campaign and adopted the Dayspring Center and cooked for the Dayspring Center. So over 50 homeless families, men and women, and their children. So, and then the year before that, I adopted a men's recovery shelter. I started doing this out of kind of, well, I would go volunteer somewhere, a soup kitchen, and I would be one of like 50 people standing there. And I didn't feel like I was best used. And,
right.
You know, everybody wants to volunteer over the holidays.
Sure.
And I thought, I know there are people that really need my help. And I just started doing something like this. Yeah.
So how did the idea to go to Standing Rock come about this year?
Like I said, just following the news. Well, not actually. There's like a not that much news, but more social media and just watching what these people are going through. I just kept feeling compelled to do something. You know, I was going to go home for Thanksgiving and eat the normal Thanksgiving meal and this year. And then I was actually driving to work the day that I started my GoFundMe account for this. So it was on Tuesday. And I was driving to work and I call one of my best friends, Julia Harkle. And I said, you know what? I said, I've got this crazy idea. I think that I want to go to Standing Rock and cook Thanksgiving, you know, cook a meal for them, not Thanksgiving dinner, but like a meal, soup or something like that, breakfast even, just cook meals for these people while they're out there protecting their land. And she's like, that's a great idea. And I said, I'm glad that you said that because I'd like you to go with me.
Oh, my goodness.
And I knew that she would go if I asked her to go. And so, yeah, that's
so
how I was kind of born.
Got any specific things you're going to cook?
I think I'm going to make beef stew for one of the meals. I'll probably make like biscuits and gravy for another. I'll make sure that I do some vegan and gluten-free options for the people that are there too. So maybe like a bean and squash soup. I just want hearty, simple meals that people know that I care about them.
Now, tell me about how people can help you out with the GoFundMe effort or get involved in your efforts to feed people at Thanksgiving.
Yeah, thank you. So you can either friend me on Facebook. It's Anna Nicole Powell. Or you can check out my GoFundMe account, and it's called Cooking for Standing Rock.
Jolene Ketzenberger with Indianapolis chef Anna Powell. Hear Jolene's Eat, Drink, Indie Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2 The Point. Speaking of Thanksgiving, 40 years ago this Thanksgiving, a young Martin Scorsese documented the final concert of the rock group The Band. That was an early collaboration of rock leaders, including Levon Helm and Robbie Robertson, and they were called The Band because they backed lots of different frontmen, including new Nobel Prize winner Bob Dylan. The band's final concert was called The Last Waltz, and on Friday, November 25th, a group of local musicians, fronted by guests Wade Parrish and Bill Mallers, will recreate the famous concert at Radio Radio.
Wade, Bill, I've seen the film several times, and I've seen three or four of your productions of the concert. But for someone who's never seen the film or may not be that familiar with the band, how would you describe The Last Waltz?
The Last Waltz was a concert by the band named The Last Waltz because they had been on the road for about 17 years, and they'd had it. So they wanted to do one final concert, and they called it The Last Waltz, and Martin Scorsese got wind of it and made what is generally known as the greatest rockumentary out of this film that's pretty iconic.
How'd you guys get started doing this? I mean, did you sit around one day and say, let's do The Last Waltz?
Yeah, really, it came about after Levon Helm, the drummer for the band, died in 2012. Is that right? 12. And the idea came up to do a tribute show for him. And so, you know, the first idea was just getting a bunch of bands together to do three or four band songs. And then it just kind of evolved into someone in our group said, hey, why don't we just play the band and we'll do, I can't remember, I think the idea of just doing The Last Waltz came up. And he said, hey, why don't we just play the band and we'll get all our friends and local musicians up to do to be the guest spot.
Yeah, we wanted to be the band because it was so much fun. Yeah. We were having so much fun doing
yeah,
it. And there were like a dozen other people that wanted to be part of the show. So we said, well, let's just do The Last Waltz and they can all do the parts. And everybody was very happy.
Well, let's get straight to that. The Last Waltz features, of course, the band, which is you guys, but also guest performances by people like Neil Young, Bob Dylan, Joni Mitchell, Van Morrison, and even Neil Diamond. How do you assemble a local crew to be all those people?
Yeah, I think it was in that first kind of run of emails where we all were throwing out ideas and, hey, this guy would be great for this, and who should we get to be Joni? And it just kind of came from brainstorming sessions.
Well, how do you balance capturing getting the music right, but also somebody who might be right for the part? So like Bob Dylan, there has to be somebody who not only can play the Bob Dylan songs, but also has to kind of have the presence of a Dylan while he's there.
Yeah, that's been one of the harder ones to fill because it's such a key role, you know, that the band was his band and, and even in the movie, you know, he's the last performance.
Well, you know, for every performer, there's certain criteria. For Joni Mitchell, we have to get a singer that is almost a trained singer, really, to be able to do that. For Bob Dylan, we need somebody that plays acoustic guitar and is kind of a singer-songwriter kind of person. So we kind of start with that.
Right, yeah,
for
they're
everybody.
Kind of, they're just practical sort of, things
yeah,
to consider.
Right. And then after that, there's enough talent in this town where, you know, then we sort of make a short list of people.
And then see who's available.
And see who's
and
available.
Who says, no, that's ridiculous, I won't do that.
Well, I mean, who's Bob Dylan this time?
Scott Rudisell, who was our stage manager for the first few years, and he maybe missed a year or something, but he's been our stage manager for most of these shows, and have been, we're all friends. And I think it was last year that he said, "So who you got for Dylan this year?" And we said, "Oh, well, you know, I think same guys last year." And he said, "Oh, okay, well." If you guys ever, we had no idea that he really wanted to do it. He was a huge Dylan fan. And so this time we thought, since it's the last one, we should have Rudy come do it.
He's definitely earned it. He's been there every year helping us out. And he's a performer in his own right.
Right,
so
as Rudy
too. He'll kill it. He'll do a great job.
Yeah. Who's the hardest person to get right, you think? Who's the most pivotal performer that absolutely has to be right?
Man, there are so many. But the first thing that comes to mind for me is I looked up, have your listeners, after you're done listening to this, look up the lyrics to the Joni Mitchell song, Coyote. It's a novel. There's three times more lyrics than any other song I've ever seen before. So that can be a challenge, finding somebody who can memorize all that. But yeah, you know, Van Morrison is really key. Such an iconic role, and Dylan. Yeah.
Are you guys in character? Like, are you Levon Helm as the drummer?
Not really. No. We loosely, you know, we have, for instance, we have two guitarists and one keyboard player, and the band had two keyboard players and one guitarist. And so, yeah, we just kind of move things around. I do all the drumming, obviously, but Tad, our bass player, does most all of the Levon singing. Bill does sing Such a Night, the Dr. John song, but then, you know, obviously, as for the rest of the night, having to cover the Garth Hudson and Richard
Manuel.
I almost said Emmanuel. I couldn't come up with it. Parts. Yeah.
So you guys have been doing this for, what, 3 or 4 years now? You've done it in a couple different cities. This is the last waltz for your last waltz. Why are you guys wrapping it up now?
Well, you know, I suppose there's always a chance that for some reason we'll want to bring the show out again. But it takes quite a bit of effort, really, to coordinate the whole thing. And it's not that we don't have a blast every single time. But I think we just thought, let's go out on a high note. For us, let's go out on a high note. I mean, we were really digging it. And we play together as a band anyway. So it's sort of like, I just think we wanted to go out on a high note. This is the 40th anniversary. Mm-hmm. It was, as most people know, a concert that was done on Thanksgiving. So we're doing it the day after Thanksgiving. So everything just seemed to align. Like, let's make this our last one and make it big. And yeah. So we decided to go back to Radio where we started.
Well, that's really great. Bill, Wade, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you.
Contributor Ben Shine with drummer Wade Parrish and pianist Bill Mallers. Their concert Such a Night, a recreation of the band's The Last Waltz, makes its final performance on Friday, November 25th at Radio. For tickets and more, visit futureshock.net. Henri is a black cat with a cushy life. His humans love him to the moon and back. And yet his life is, well, lacking that je ne sais quoi. If you recognize this character, you're one of the millions who've tuned in to watch Will Braden's Henri Le Chat Noir on YouTube. You can meet Will at the IMA's Internet Cat Video Festival in just a few days. I rang him up to learn how he created his signature feline star.
So, not to be too philosophical about it, but I'm curious, did you discover that Henri was French or a philosopher first?
Well, I discovered first that he looked great on camera, and everything else came beyond that. It started as just a film school project, and I was supposed to do a profile of someone, and I decided I would do a profile of Henry, the cat, and I realized he didn't really do anything on his own. He had a pretty boring life, so I decided to make him French and a philosopher, and I thought that would be a little bit funnier.
And how do you and he come up with his material?
Well, I sort of come up with a rough outline for each little short film that we do, and then I let maybe half of the jokes come from the filming and just things that pop into my head as we do it. And he has a very good imperious stare. It's very sort of a blank canvas. So as soon as you make it black and white and you put the piano music on it and you do the French, it's a really a good blank canvas, and he'll sell any joke.
And people who aren't so fond of cats will say, well, duh, he's a cat. Of course he's imperious.
Right. Actually, there was an article written about him that said that Henri's videos were cat videos for people that hate cats.
It's so untrue.
Not always, but if it works that way too, then great. Crossover deal, I guess.
So I have to ask, you do have other four-legged children in the household. Are they jealous?
Well, I have to confess, Henry doesn't actually live with me. He lives with a family member, but I have my own cat. But her name is Nin, and she's a Bengal, and all she does is run around and cause mischief. And she wouldn't sit still long enough to ever be filmed.
So she might have a book someday, but not an internet series.
Yeah, she might do some sort of a parkour you know, video series or something, but that's about all she does is knock things off the table.
Is the imbecile white kitty cat then that actually lives with Henry in your family
yes.
member's household? Okay.
Yeah, and he actually, so Henry, the real cat that portrays Henri, is not really anything like the character. He's very happy and he doesn't have any problems. I don't think he suffers from ennui, but the white imbecile is absolutely just like his character, just a vacant lot for a head. He's got nothing going on up there. He's scared of everything. So he was really playing himself, I think.
So did you have any idea what a monster, and I don't mean Henry or Henri, but the franchise you were creating when you got into this? I mean, did you hope?
No.
Did you hope?
No.
No?
I mean, I had no idea. I mean, when this first started, I was in film school. It was 2006. It's been 10 years. YouTube was barely even around. There was
yeah.
no Facebook. There was no Twitter. And so I had no idea that this was something that could turn into, you know, a livelihood. I was just excited when a few people saw it online and it was shared on blogs, and that was about it. It wasn't until 2012 when the Cat Video Festival sort of took hold that I thought, oh, this could really be something. There was a book deal and we did an online store and all that. And then very slowly I started to think, okay, this could actually be something.
Yeah. Is there, you know, I'm thinking of some of your compatriots, like the person who is allowed to live with Lil Bub or Grumpy Cat. Is there were you ever approached by an agent who says, I specialize in internet cats or famous cats? Or is there such a thing?
No comment. There is such a thing.
No.
But there is such a thing, but it's a little bit different with Henri because... like, for Grumpy Cat, for example, it's really about the visual, you
yeah.
know, and then everything, it becomes a meme and people can sort of do something on its own. Henri is really a character, and so without all the specifics of it, it doesn't really work. If you just took a picture of Henri and put it in black and white, then, yeah, it's just a good-looking cat in black and white, but it doesn't really sell
it. It doesn't have his personality,
so.
Yeah.
Right.
Do
so,
you...
No, it was, for better or for worse, it was always going to be me doing it.
Do your friends and maybe your significant other ever try to stage an intervention and say, stop seeing the world through Henri's eyes?
You know, it was funny because when this first started, there was a good chunk of time when I had fully committed to just doing this full time and having this be my livelihood. And I would try to explain it to people. And they just wouldn't get it. I go, yeah, they, you know, you'd meet somebody at a party. What do you do? Oh, I make cat videos. Oh, I know, but I mean, like, what do you really do? No, that's what I do. Right, but I mean, you have a mortgage. Like, how do you pay the mortgage? And I go, that's what I do. So it was a hard sell. And then it's really been a couple of years. And now, the other day, I was on a plane flight, and I was chatting with a guy who was sitting next to me, and I asked him what he did, and he's an accountant. And then he said, what do you do? And I said, oh, I make cat videos. And he goes, oh, great. Like, that was just a normal
Good for you.
It's been a complete change in
about 2 years. You legitimated it. Good for you. Good going.
Well, I don't know if I did it on my own, but at least I've been part of the wave.
Well, I'm just delighted to talk with you, and we can't wait to see what unfolds because, you know, philosophers just keep developing their theories over the years.
It's true. He's into sort of the second phase of his career and his analysis on human nature, I think. he, spoiler alert, he's very disdainful of human nature.
Rien n'a pas changé. J'ai entendu que je suis célèbre sur l'internet.
Until now, after I did this conversation with Will, this interview, I went home and I talked to my two indoor cats and I said, so boys, how can we reproduce?
How can you help mom retire early?
Mom retire early? And you did.
And what did they say, Sharon?
They said, life has no meaning. You know, you never bring us enough new
cats with
toys.
An attitude. I can't believe it.
It's just shocking. And here's somebody who figured out how to monetize that. God love him. Good for Will Braden. And The Internet Cat Video Festival sells out every year. And a reminder, you really cannot bring your own pet. Just bring your videos of your pets on your phone. But you can find
leave
out
your
if,
catnip at home.
Leave your catnip at home. But you can find out if you can still score a ticket at imamuseum.org. So do we have any other animal-related items?
I don't know. We should take a look, though, shouldn't we?
On our calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
Mew.
The dogs are going to be upset. We're going to have to come back.
Equal time.
Pause.
Okay,
Santa Paws is coming soon. So
Santa Paws. Because
it is holiday time.
Maybe you should create an internet dog video festival.
There we go. There are holiday things coming up,
though. There are so many holiday things. In fact, I have an item that doesn't have a cat or a dog, but it has a mouse in it.
Okay.
Yes, it's time for the annual onslaught of productions and performances of The Nutcracker. Join the Indiana Ballet Conservatory for its production at the Indianapolis Museum of Art December 8th through the 11th. And no, I'm not kidding. It really isn't too soon to start scoring your tickets.
No, they're all very good productions, mm-hmm. and there are multiple productions out there, and it's worth your time to see them all because they're all different, and they all support really good causes,
Absolutely.
Too.
Absolutely.
If you're still looking for something to do, though, yet this weekend and next, at the Basile Opera Center, they've got the Modus Dance. They have their Cultivate, which is a showcase of new choreographers. Starts at 7 o'clock, Saturday, Sunday, this weekend, and next weekend, both. And they're going to give awards to some of the participants there, too, so that's a good thing. And then out at Oak Landon at their Civic Theater, both this weekend and next, they are presenting Vintage Hitchcock, a live radio play.
Ooh,
how about that?
That's fun.
Once again, the 12th, the 13th, the 18th, and the 19th, the Oak Landon Civic Theater. And if you need to learn about more to do in the arts world of Indianapolis, you can go to the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide. It's at indiearts.org/guide.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Past Indiana poet laureate Norbert Kraft agrees with Franz Kafka that a book must be the axe for the frozen sea within us. For most of his 5 decades as a writer, he's wielded poetry as that weapon, most notably in 2015's Catholic Boy Blues, A Poet's Journal of Healing. Recently, though, Norbert realized that he needed prose to tell part of his story, and the result is the newly published Shrinking the Monster, Healing the Wounds of Our Abuse. A note, our conversation is not appropriate for young children, so tune away for a few minutes if you have little ones nearby.
I'll never forget a moment I recorded in my journal during that trip to Germany. At one point in our discussions about the abuse, Petra, who like Helmut grew up on a Franconian farm, turned her beautiful pale blue eyes on me and said in German, with the utmost sincerity and conviction, "Norbert, you have done nothing whatsoever wrong. Do you understand?" In the entry I wrote early the next morning, I said, "Petra is not my sister-in-law. She is my sister in spirit."
I love that because it's so simple. It's such a simple declarative statement.
Mm-hmm.
But not everyone would understand that it needs to be said to you.
Yes.
How did writing this book help you, and how did you, at what point did you realize that writing Catholic Boy Blues, which was such a journey and such, I gather, a cathartic experience in so many ways, but you needed to go back, but this time in prose. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, that's because a new publisher took over Catholic Boy Blues after it was out a year and the first publisher folded, and he invited me to do this book. I probably wouldn't have done it on my own, but when he invited me to do it, I thought for about 3 seconds, and I said, yes, that would be a good idea, and it most certainly did help me put things in perspective and see how healing the writing of the poems, the publishing of them, which was a challenge, all of that was a challenge, and then sharing them with people, there was such an affirmative reaction when I was afraid that there would be, I didn't know what to expect. I thought there might be angry letters and phone calls and so on, and I was worried about my family and
sure.
so on and so forth, so we took precautions. But none of that really happened, even though I know some people wish I hadn't written the book, but that's always the case when you deal with a subject like this.
Norbert?
Yes?
Their reaction is not your responsibility.
No, it isn't. That's right.
You know that.
No, but my family's safety
yeah.
is.
No,
that's what
I
meant.
Understand.
Yeah.
I understand.
But you're absolutely right. If you worried about the response to what you're going to write, you might not write it, or you might write it in a different way, and you might start censoring yourself, and that's bad.
It also strikes me that one of the great things about this prose book is not all of us are poets. Not everybody has the gift of the poetic voice. But through following your process, I mean, this book reads and I gather is largely based on your journals.
Yes.
And this is a narrative experience, which I think will be a role model for people who maybe don't have the gift of poetry or music or visual art, and they can find their way through another kind of expression of healing.
Yes, I think so. And Liza Hyatt, poet therapist Liza Hyatt, and I do a workshop we're now calling Bless This Mess, writing about difficult relationships. And we keep telling them, we want to get you started. You don't have to be a published poet or fiction writer or prose writer. You just need to find a way to start telling your story.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start telling your story, you're going to feel much better. And each little step of the story is going to help you feel better and help you heal. And we always say, don't even think about publication and don't worry about editing it now. Just get it started. And that's what I did, too.
In a way, what you've discussed, and when I say finding a voice, I mean, of course, multiple things. There's the voices, the four voices
yes.
that you write in, the four hats you wear, so to speak, in Catholic Boy Blues. But there's also finding some kind of a narrative voice, as you've just talked about in your workshops. Of course, we'd love for people to take your workshop, but share some kind of prompt that you've helped people with.
Well, one of the things we tell them is to just talk up if you're writing about, it doesn't have to be an abuse. It can be any difficult relationship with a sibling, a parent, or a friend, or
ex-friend. Dealing with a disease.
But just describe a scene when maybe it started or some incident, and just get it right. And don't think about what other people are going to say, because sometimes a participant will say, well, but what do I do about editing? What do I do about what other people think? And I said, you don't think about that. That's not your responsibility now, as you told me, you know. And later on, you can edit. And if you – sometimes there is an issue of privacy, but that's not for you to think about now. You can edit out some things that maybe would be a little too private and would betray a confidence. You can take care of that later.
You and Liza are the great permission givers
yes.
in this workshop, right?
That's exactly right. We want to give them permission to write and to tell their story, because difficult relationships, especially abusive ones, especially for young people, take away their power of language. They can't tell their story. And if you start telling your story, you regain some of your power and some of your confidence, and it's healing. And you can tell your story, and then you might need other help, too, depending on what kind of a difficult relationship you were involved in. But you really are helping to heal yourself. And by the time I got into therapy, I'd already written 250 poems before a year was over, and it became 325. But then I had to get away from that for about 3 years, more most of the time, in order to get some distance and let it settle. And then, but I was Indiana Poet Laureate doing 100 public appearances a year, too, and I had no time for it.
So there's that very literal barrier keeping you from going back. But while these many expressions were percolating, how did you feel the moment was ripe to go back and deal with selecting the poems for the book?
Well, I had to finish being Indiana Poet Laureate, and I had a chance to serve two more years, and I declined because I didn't know how long it would take me to do that editing and selecting, and I didn't want to confuse the new position of Indiana Poet Laureate. I was only the first one.
That's right.
Selected. Yeah. The first one with Joyce Brinkman was appointed by the legislature, so that I thought maybe it would happen faster, and then it would be a book published by the Indiana Poet Laureate, and there, it might create resistance to having the position continued,
you
know. Oh. So, I mean, I just had a sense, too, that I needed more time. Yeah.
Do you have aspirations for there to be a time when you can look at your writing and say, I don't have one more word to say about this?
Well, I doubt that it'll come to that, but the more I write, probably the better I will feel about my recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think about mostly. But, I mean, I'm thinking about, in fact, I've decided to try to adapt Catholic Boy Blues into a play.
Really?
Yes.
With four actors portraying the different voices?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Ooh.
Yeah. And I think it's a natural. I haven't had experience as a playwright. But someone worked on it for a while and then had to stop for various reasons. And I had a conversation with the playwright in residence at IRT, James Still. Mm-hmm. He knows about this.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him this young man was working on an adaptation. He said, Norbert, why don't you do it yourself? It's your story. And I said, I'm going to try. After that other deal fell through, I said, now I will try and I will see what I can do. And if I can't do it, then I will let someone else do it. But I would like to learn how to do that, too. And I'm excited about trying it.
Jasper, Indiana-born, past Poet Laureate of Indiana, Norbert Kraft. His new prose book is Shrinking the Monster, Healing the Wounds of Our Abuse. And you can learn more about his writing, workshops, and readings at kraftpoetry.com. That's KRAPF poetry.com. Even if you haven't planned a party, when you invite Jefferson Street Parade Band to show up, you'll have a party. Think New Orleans Second Line meets rock, pop, and world music. Up next, a Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long visits with drummer and Jefferson Street Parade Band co-founder Ben Fowler.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto. I'm joined in the studio tonight by percussionist Ben Fowler, founder of Bloomington, Indiana's amazing Jefferson Street Parade Band. They have a new album coming out November 18th titled Viral. And Ben, you have five songs unrelated to the new album release. You have five songs picked out to share with our listeners tonight, right?
Yes, I do. I thought I would throw out one of the original versions of a song that JSPB covers. This is the original Kunkobatu by Famadou Konaté. Next up, I have Beyond Games by the Tony Williams Lifetime. This track, well, let's see, when I was like a freshman in high school, my mother worked at Borders Books, and I had a friend over in the CD section, and he knew I was a drummer, so he said, oh, you gotta get this album called Emergency. And this is track two off Emergency. I've been listening to it ever since.
Why don't you say what you mean? Because you didn't mean what you said. When you're aware, it's knowing that there are people who are sharing.
Number three, we've got I'm Yours, You're Mine by Morphine, and that's a really cool saxophone heavy track from their last album, which I really love, called The Night.
And they were a trio, right? It was bass, baritone sax, and drums. Is that correct?
That's right. That's how they played live. I heard a bootleg of theirs where they were touring with a bass sax at one point, which you hardly ever see because I don't know if a person can even pick up a bass sax. They're a really, really enormous instrument. And their sax player would sometimes play tenor and Barry at the same time. This particular album, there's definitely some organ, some piano. I think John Medeski from Medeski, Martin and Wood plays organ on some of these tracks. Really interesting band, really cool music. This is Os Mutanges.
Great Brazilian psychedelic band. Yeah,
yeah, such an interesting bunch of music they made. And this is, I think, just a really, really beautiful song. Their second album is one of my favorite albums of all time, and this track I just find really beautiful.
Thank you for sharing that. I had the opportunity to bring them to Indianapolis in 2012 at the White Rabbit in Fountain Square.
That's fantastic.
That was one of the greatest days of my life.
Oh, man. I got to see them at the Metro when they did their reunion tour probably that same year or around there. And it was wonderful. It was a rockin' time. Yeah.
Great. Thank you for picking that. And your last song for us, Ben.
India by John Coltrane from Live at the Village Vanguard. This is the John Coltrane Quartet along with Eric Dolphy on bass clarinet.
I've been joined by percussionist Ben Fowler of Bloomington, Indiana's Jefferson Street Parade Band. They have an amazing new album out. It's titled Viral. It's coming out November 18th. And Ben, what's the best place for people to find this album online?
JeffersonSTParadeBand.bandcamp.com.
And you guys have a Facebook page where people can keep track of your live dates, which I definitely recommend catching.
That's correct. Find us on Facebook. Once again, we go by Jefferson ST Parade Band, typically online. So if you search Facebook for Jefferson ST Parade Band, you'll find us.
Thank you, Ben. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Kyle.
Kyle Long with Jefferson Street Parade Band's Ben Fowler. Hear Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Wednesday nights at 9 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for spending some time with The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Today's contributors included Pete Brown and Ben Schein. You can hear our program twice each week on 90.1 FM, Saturday mornings at 7 and Thursday evenings at 8. And if you hear something you like and want to share, go to WFYI.org for our podcast. Tune in next week when we'll discover Eli Lilly at the start of his amazing career, learn how to collect oral histories with StoryCorps' David Isay, and do some early browsing at the Yelp Holiday Bazaar. And of course, we'll have that arts calendar we call What'll We Do? All that and so much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, producer Melissa Davis, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.